And now I've...
Turn on the tape recorder. So, most of the talks, if not the vast majority of the talks I give, I start out with a theme. I talk about my own experience and the teachings of the Buddha as recorded in the Pali Canon, because I'm a Theravadin. But tonight I thought I'd do something a little bit different. Never done this before, so bear with me. I'm going to talk about a subject, but I'm going to introduce this subject by reading from the writing of a great American novelist and writer, died a couple of years ago. I can't speak to anybody's greatness as a writer because that's completely a matter of opinion. I can say with some sense of certainty that there are a few more influential writers in the past 20 years, more influential than David Foster Wallace. He wrote what many consider to be one of the most important books, novels of the last 20 years, Infinite Jest. He wrote a number of collections of essays that are really, really funny. And I'm not here to sell his work. But before a few years before he died, he gave a commencement address to the graduating class of Kenyon. And in this speech he gave, which is, you can hear on YouTube by simply entering Kenyon and then David Foster Wallace. By the way, I'm going to shorten his name to DFW from now on because it gets really tiresome to say that. You can just type in his name in Kenyon and hear the entire address. It's one of the most astonishing and profound talks I've ever heard. And many people agree because it's regularly been reprinted in Great American Speeches and in the most important essays of 2006, it was included. And it's often referred to as an example of the great, perfect commencement speech. Also, one of the reasons why I'm going to be reading from it is it's also known as David Foster Wallace's Buddhist speech, where he talks about the themes that became important to him as an adult, and what he thought were the important things for all of us to keep in mind. Now, in this quote, I've excerpted it because it's far too long. I think it runs 12 minutes, and I wanted to just get to the heart of the issues that he brought up. And then I'm going to talk about Buddhist solutions to the issues that he brings up, which are primarily dealing with self-centeredness, dealing with that feeling of being alone or in the world in opposition to everyone else, or that feeling of the lens that we view all of our lives through, that everything is happening to us. You'll hear through his description the topic, and then I'll talk about Buddhist strategies to dealing with this. So DFW starts this speech by giving an analogy of two young fish that are swimming along in the water, and they come across an elder fish who says, "Hello, boys, how's the water today?" And they just nod and keep swimming along, and about 15 minutes later, one of the fish looks at the other and says, "What's water?" And David Foster Wallace goes on to use this as an example of that there are certain mind states that we're in that we don't realize are just a small part of all the possibilities. Just as the fish don't know that water is not everything, because water is so everything to them, they don't even know what it is. There's no concept of sky or anything else. We live in a mind state where we are incapable of recognizing that there's any alternative. And from here on, I'm going to be quoting with a couple of interjections. Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I am the absolute center of the universe, the realest, most vivid, and important person in existence. We rarely think about this sort of natural basic self-centeredness because it's so socially repulsive. But it's pretty much the same for all of us. It's our default setting. It's hardwired into our boards at birth. Think about it. There's no experience that you have had that you are not the absolute center of. The world as you experience it is there in front of you, and it's behind you, to the left and to the right of you. It's on your TV and on your monitor. He goes on to say that the work is, in quotes, getting free of my natural hardwired default setting, which is to be deeply and literally self-centered, where everything is interpreted through the lens of self. People who can adjust their natural default setting this way are described as being, in quotes, he says, well-adjusted, which I suggest to you is not an accidental term. It is extremely difficult to stay alert and attentive instead of getting hypnotized by the constant monologue inside our own head. Learning how to think really means learning how to exercise some control over how and what you think. It means being conscious and aware enough to choose what you pay attention to, and to choose how you construct meaning from your experience. Because if you cannot exercise this kind of choice in adult life, you will be totally hosed. DFW goes into a long and often hilarious description of the self-centeredness of adult life, and I'm going to read some of it. He talks about being an adult who has a job and who realizes that there's no food for dinner. So the adult has to, after work, go to the supermarket. And this is what, in our most normal mind state, we experience as the supermarket. The supermarket is a hideously lit and infused with soul-killing muzak or corporate pop. It's pretty much the last place you want to be, but you can't just get in and out quickly. The checkout line is incredibly long, filled with people that are stupid and cow-like, dead-eyed and inhuman. You have to drive all the way home through slow, heavy rush hour traffic that is clogged by the huge, stupid, lane-blocking SUVs and Hummers and V12 pickup trucks burning their wasteful, selfish 40-gallon tanks of gas. The patriotic or religious bumper stickers always seem to be on the biggest, most disgustingly selfish vehicles, driven by the ugliest, most inconsiderate and aggressive drivers. At this point in the speech, the students get up and give a standing ovation. And DFW has to remind them that this is the example of how not to think. My natural default setting is the certainty that situations like this are really all about me, about my hungriness, my fatigue, and my desire to just get home. If you're automatically sure that you know what reality is and you are operating on your default setting, then you, like me, probably won't consider other possibilities. But if you really learn how to pay attention, then you will know there are other options. It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell situation as not only meaningful but sacred, on fire with the same force that made the stars. And the compelling reason for choosing some sort of spiritual type thing, and here he really gets to the crux, the compelling reason to choose something spiritual to worship, be it Jesus Christ or Allah, the Wiccan Mother Goddess, or the Four Noble Truths, or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they are where you tap real meaning in life, then you will never have enough. You will never feel you have enough. And that's the truth. Worship your body and your beauty and your sexual lure, and you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. He's actually quoting the Buddha there. The whole trick is keeping the truth up in front of your daily consciousness. The so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default self-centered settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums merrily along on the fuel of fear and anger and frustration and craving, where have we heard that before, and the worship of self. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in a myriad of unsexy ways every day. That is real freedom. The alternative is unconsciousness. The default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. So I can't think of more powerful ways to put forth the Buddhist agenda. And he begins to hint at some of the ways to deal with this self-centered feeling of the feelings that I'm going through are mine alone. These are my thoughts. Nobody has ever had these thoughts before. Nobody understands me. That everything is about me. That other people are in my way. That when people are saying things that I don't like, they're attacking me. They're not just saying whatever is going on with them. All this self-centered lens that we experience life, he begins to offer some solutions. He talks, of course, about empathy. In the talk, he talks about how in those big SUVs and Hummers, there might actually be a father driving a sick child to a hospital. We don't know. We assume that it's always the worst, most inconvenient truth to ourselves. We don't really know what's behind those tinted screens or what that person has been through. So there's a certain opening up, he's asking, towards compassion. And this compassion or this empathy, of course, undermines this sense that it's me against you. There's also, in the final part of the speech, an emphasis upon generosity. He talks about the myriad of unsexy ways that we can help others. And this idea of being of service and of offering our time and our aid and our help or even just our attention to other people undermines the sense that I'm coming into the world from a place of scarcity, not having enough, that you are in competition with me and that everything I have, including my peace and my calm and everything I own is mine to hoard, because if I open myself up to you, I'm risking my safety, because my safety comes from hoarding and being protective. So being generous undermines this sense of me versus everyone else, this self-centered worldview. And it's very clear from his talk, I'm not sure that the excerpts I chose really gave it away, but he's trying to get across this very important notion that the reason to work against self-centeredness or this kind of self-centeredness, and I'm not talking about self-centeredness just protecting yourself. I'm talking about self-centeredness where it becomes suffering and stress, where we no longer can, where we feel like unprotected, where we feel like we have to constantly be on our guard, where we feel like if we don't take care of ourselves, everything's going to fall apart. This kind of also where it's us against everyone. This is the kind of self-centeredness we have to explore alleviating because it causes stress, not just for the people around us, not only because it consumes the world and the world's resources, but because in a very fundamental way, self-centeredness is stress. When we feel it's us against everyone else or everything is about us, that is painful. It makes us unique and isolated. It makes us incapable of really feeling that other people get us. It makes us refrain from sharing and opening our hearts. It makes us be protective and walled off. So this is very real something that we should, if for no other reason than our own self-interest, let go of self-centeredness. So a third technique that he's talking about that works is, of course, virtue, which is if we refrain as often as we can on a day-by-day basis from causing harm, be it from stealing, from using our speech unskillfully, from using sex, or from using anything else in a way that causes harm. There's nothing wrong with sex, but using it in a way that doesn't cause harm to ourselves or other beings. Using our livelihood in a way not to cause harm. All of these attributes, these activities, refraining from causing harm, this virtue also, again, chips away at this self-centeredness that he's talking about. But he also mentions, and he doesn't really go into it, and I'm going to explain, hopefully, what we should bear in mind. He talks about, finally, see if I can get you the exact quote, the really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline. So what is that? Well, the Buddha, beyond all these external approaches to undermining self-centeredness, generosity, gratitude, virtue, empathy, all of these are externally facing. They're the way we relate to others. But there's also an internal practice called mindfulness. The Buddha, in the Honeycomb Sutta, the 18th Sutta, is asked, what is the cause of our self-centered conflict with other people? And he answers, well, when we make contact with other people, before we even think, there's this underlying feeling state in the body called Vedana. And this feeling state is either one of positive, liking what's going on in the world, or it's negative, not liking. It's a resistance, a physical. So there's an opening up, or there's a sheltering, or there's the third, which is no opinion. But beneath everything we think, and before everything we think, the Buddha believed that there is an underlying gut feeling. Now, it so happens that he turned out to be correct. Thousands of years later, neuroscientists have shown, Antonio Damasio, shown conclusively that before we have, and Benjamin Leggett also in his wonderful Mind Time, neuroscientists show that before there is thinking, there is underlying feeling states, body contractions, tensions, that predispose us towards either feeling safe and good about what's happening or feeling averse to what's going on. This is the unconscious mind talking to us through the body. And then the mind registers what's going on, and then it adds thinking on top of it. And the Buddha explained exactly that. He literally, thousands of years before these demonstrations through fMRI scans, he literally said, before there's thinking, there's feeling, and then there's thought, and that thought turns into what he called papancha. And papancha is the Buddha's word for self-centered thought that multiplies and fills up the mind with thinking and thinking and thinking. What do you think about me? What's going to happen to me? What are those people? How do I relate to them? How do I compare? How much money will I have in the future? All of this self-centered thinking fills up the mind. It multiplies and it causes stress and suffering. So you might, if you're following, what the Buddha is going to get at is because feeling starts before thinking, before self-centered thinking, there's an opportunity there. If we keep ourselves mindfully aware of where the body registers its disapproval and its approval, we can, through a process he called yoniso manasikara or sati, mindfulness, yoniso manasikara means appropriate attention, either approach works. The Buddha said there was three parts to appropriate attention and mindfulness. What are they? The exact same ones that David Foster Wallace says. They are attention and awareness and discipline. The exact same three. Attention is sati. It means knowing what to pay attention to, focusing on the body first. Awareness, sampajana, means opening and simply seeing what's happening in your body, watching the feelings arise and pass without needing to follow what they want you to do. So many times in life when we're in a conversation that turns a little conflictual with somebody else, I don't even know if that's a word, but conflict, and we start feeling ourselves heating up. We start feeling the hairs on the back of our neck go up. We feel the skin get warm. We start feeling the stomach tense. Perhaps the shoulders get tight. Perhaps the throat gets tight. There's an underlying vedana that occurs. And then this stress makes us so uncomfortable that we say something unskillful because we want to get all this discomfort out of us and onto that other person. We want to make the underlying feeling go away by hurting the other person. We want to stop the conversation. We want them to go away. We want the feeling to go away by externalizing it. So the point of mindfulness is to relax what's going on in the body, because if we are relaxed inside, then we will not say or do something unskillful externally. And even more so than that, the more we practice mindfulness, we find that beneath all of the self-centered inner monologues that David Foster Wallace says that we're hypnotized by, all of these worries about these fears, these worries about what's going to happen to us or how other people think about us or all that stuff, if we look beneath it, always there is that underlying physical stress, that underlying vedana. And if we want to detach from the monologue, the strongest, most efficient tool we have, even stronger than empathy, than compassion, than generosity, than virtue, the most effective tool we have is to find the body, because that detaches us from our thoughts and it will relax and bring some sense of peace to what's going on within. If we can use the breath and the mind to relax the body, we will not feel so vulnerable in the world because we have an area of security in our life. We have something that's like what Ajahn Jeff calls an inner fortress, a place that's safe, a place where we don't have to protect ourselves. And because we have that place, we don't feel vulnerable outside in the world. We actually can be open and generous and empathetic, and we actually can relate to people. But when we are self-centered, when we are trapped in this sense of it's me versus everybody else, it's because inside of us there's stress, there's discomfort. The body, the breath, the entire being state is uncomfortable. So this is what is the deepest solution to this agenda. When DFW talks about awareness and attention and discipline, he's talking about having the discipline again and again and again, no matter how important the world seems, no matter how important other people seem and drama seem and the TV show seems and the work seems, keeping at least a little bit aware of what's going on within, breathing, relaxing, finding the body, finding the breath, finding the areas in your body where you carry that stress, knowing your body, and then becoming able to relax it so that you too have a tool that separates you from that hypnotizing monologue that renders us, as he says, so unconscious, so fearful, and so filled with stress. So,